This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence and a high-level delegation is heading to Turkey Wednesday at President Trump's request to press that country's president to stop his invasion of northeast Syria. Trump says he's ready to slap Turkey with sanctions following Turkey's military maneuvers.
It would be very tough on Turkey and a lot of others. They have to maintain their own properties now. They have to maintain peace and safety. And we'll see what happens. The delegation, we're asking for a ceasefire.
U.S. Democrats and Republicans blame the Trump administration for what is unfolding in northern Syria, saying the withdrawal of U.S. forces from the area cleared the way for the U.S. ally Syrian Defense Forces to be put in danger, as well as increasing the potential for Islamic State militants under the SDF detention to escape and stage a resurgence. U.S. Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff says a case of obstruction by the Trump administration continues to build after senior members and Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani defied subpoenas in the impeachment inquiry. The AP's Ed Donahue has more.
President Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, notified lawmakers he will not comply with a subpoena. At the White House, the president honored the Stanley Cup champions.
The St. Louis Blues' amazing comeback reminds us to never give up.
But it wasn't all hockey talk. On impeachment, with Missouri Republican Senator Roy Blunt in the crowd, the president didn't seem too concerned.
I wouldn't worry about it, fellas. I wouldn't worry about it. Don't worry too much. How are we doing, Roy? Okay in the Senate? I hear we're looking very good.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says the matter at hand with Ukraine is at the heart of the integrity of American elections.
And it must be investigated thoroughly, completely, and in a nonpartisan manner.
Ed Donahue, Washington.
And for more news, please join us at our website. That is voanews.com or the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News. 12 U.S. Democratic presidential candidates squared off in a spirited debate Tuesday night, all looking to confront President Trump in next year's presidential election. One of the leading candidates, Senator Bernie Sanders, says President Trump is damaging the U.S. reputation with his policy moves on Syria. Sanders cited the withdrawal of troops from northern Syria and Turkey's attack on the Kurds who worked with the U.S. in fighting ISIS.
Now, Turkey is not a U.S. ally when they invade another country and engage in mass slaughter.
The dozens of challengers, including Sanders, also expressed their support for the four-week-old impeachment probe, although President Trump's removal through the impeachment process remains an unlikely outcome. The International Monetary Fund is downgrading its new outlook for the world economy, saying trade wars are having an effect. AP correspondent Charles de la Desma has the story.
The International Monetary Fund is pessimistic about the world economy, predicting that growth this year will be the weakest since the 2008 financial crisis, primarily because of widening global conflicts. The World Economic Outlook foresees a slight rebound in 2020, but warns of tensions ranging from heightened political dramas in the Middle East to the threat that the US and China will fail to prevent their trade war from escalating. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The death toll in the worst typhoon to hit Japan for decades climbed to 66 on Tuesday. Ryan Brooks reports.
Japan is still picking up the pieces after a massive typhoon struck over the weekend. The death toll on Tuesday rose to 66. But with hundreds injured and more than a dozen still missing, that number may continue to tick up. Fukushima Prefecture was among the worst hit. Typhoon Hagibis left a trail of destruction there. Local media reports at least 25 people in Fukushima were killed, including a mother and child swept up by floodwaters. Most of those who died, however, were the elderly. Parliament on Tuesday held a moment of silence to remember victims of the typhoon. Tokyo has set aside $4.5 billion for disaster recovery and has vowed to find more funds if needed.
That's Reuters' Ryan Brooks reporting. Mexico's Senate will reportedly vote for a bill to fully legalize marijuana in the next few days, a major step toward changing the country's approach to the drug by removing it as a source of income for violent drug gangs. If approved by the Senate, the proposal would then proceed to the lower house for a vote. Late last year, the Supreme Court said lawmakers have until October 24th to legalize marijuana after the High Court ruled in several cases the prohibition of the recreational use of the drug violates the Constitution. From here in Washington, this is VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, October 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberian police used tear gas on Tuesday to disperse public school students demonstrating to demand their teachers pay.
Actually, as an aggravate, the police respond, because in spite of all of the stone throwing, all of that, the police really use minimum force, because we have always asked the police to be reticent in how they handle our citizens.
Eugene Nambo is Liberia's information minister. Guinean opposition and civil society groups plan more protests today, Wednesday, against a likely third term for President Alpha Conde. Thousands face evictions as Kenya's bid to save Mau Forest intensifies. And Zimbabwe's finance minister says the country's economy is facing temporary problems.
The economy is reforming quite faster. These reforms are largely positive. They are setting the economy up for a very bright future and prosperity towards Vision 2030.
Umtule Mumbe is the Zimbabwe's finance minister, and we'll speak with the author of a new book, An Impossible Inheritance, Post-Colonial Psychiatry and the Work of Memory in West African Clinic. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberian police used tear gas Tuesday to disperse public school students who were demonstrating to demand their teachers pay. Some students said their teachers have not been paid for 4 months. The Ministry of Finance says it had disbursed the September salaries of teachers at the Monrovia Consolidated School System. Liberia this year has experienced a number of protests from doctors and nurses to university professors in the wake of a struggling economy. Minister of Information Eugene Nambwe says the government is currently restructuring its pay system, which accounts for the delay. He also says the police use minimum force to disperse the students, despite the students throwing rocks at the police.
Some students, particularly from the Monrovia Consolidated School System, protested on the streets of Monrovia because they had thought that the government wasn't paying their teachers. But the reality of the situation is that of the about 1,200 teachers that MCSS has, over 900 of them were already paid and the rest were being paid. You know, the government is currently undergoing a pay restructure exercise. So there are some times that we have these processing issues. So all of the pay issues with the teachers, their teachers were being addressed. In fact, a vast majority, about over 900, were already paid, and there were 200 who have received partial payments. Now, the information did not filter down properly, and that caused the students to jump in the streets. But I can also tell you that we shouldn't exaggerate the police response, because in spite of all of the stone throwing, all of that, the police really use minimum force, because we have always asked the police to be reticent in how they handle our citizens.
But Mr. Minister, so is it true that the teachers have not been paid for 4 months?
It is not true. Actually, the entire payroll for teachers in Liberia is around 17,000 teachers. Out of the 17,000, we have about 1,200 that work for the MCSS. Now, out of that 1,200, 900 have already been paid. Why? Just over 200 were being paid. So I'm saying that the government has been very current compared to other sectors with teachers' pay. So we continue to give the information to the population, to the citizens, so that they understand that this process that we are undergoing is in the greater interest of the country, because we are harmonizing the pay structure and we are also making the budget to reflect our actual domestic and international revenue collection, so that the budget will be a fairly balanced budget without, you know, all of the inflationary tendencies that we have had in the past. So this is a program that we are working on with the IMF, because we want to enter a program that IMF will support.
We had a similar situation like this at the University of Liberia and at William V. Stoutmore University. Now it has trickled down to public high school students and high school teachers. Is it a matter of economic generally, or is it just an adjustment of the structure?
Well, we do admit that we face a very stringent economic situation in the country. This is why these measures that have been taken, not just the harmonization of pay, but some of the austerity measures and some of the measures to have a budget that has integrity, these things are necessary for the country to pick up and regain economic growth. So, yes, there's sporadic issues of demonstration by some of the civil servants, including teachers and health workers. But the Ministry of Finance that is paying these people have been working time. And this process that has been undertaken right now, things are simmering down. Nobody can come to you now and say the government's owing them 3 months. Those who are owed for August have been paid, and people are receiving their pay for last month. We are trying to bring all of the pay situation up to current. This is why it's ongoing, you know. So we have to do a little bit more as a government to inform the citizens, to explain to them that the process will have some teething problems.
Eugene Nabo is Liberia's information minister. He was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. Guinean opposition political parties and civil society groups say they plan more protests today, Wednesday, against a possible third-term bid by President Alpha Condé. The opposition says the president is trying to engineer a third term after his current second and constitutionally mandated final term ends in 2020. Government spokesman Amara Sampare says President Condé will speak on the matter after the conclusion of a nationwide consultation. Sidya Touré, leader of the Opposition Union of Republican Forces Party, says the police killed seven people during protests yesterday and Monday.
We have two killed today. We're told a rise to seven people was killed from yesterday to today. In the rallies in the town against his third mandate of Alpha Condé, was police people shoot some of our militants. As I say, we have seven people who died.
Let me say that we tried to speak to the Minister of Information. I think he said that the government has identified the Interior Minister to be the spokesperson. What exactly is the government saying?
I don't know, because we didn't hear nothing. We only say that they're going to send policemen to stop the manifestation, but we have a real problem here. We don't want a third mandate of Alpha Condé. This is the main problem we have. And if we want to have a situation going down, the only thing is to say the constitution says that you have two terms in the Guinean constitution. If you finish it, you know, you can go and somebody can have a term for presidency.
I know that the president has not said yet whether he wants a third term. What exactly you, the opposition, would like for the president? What would you want to hear him say?
He said it clearly when he was in New York. We have to prepare people because we are going to a referendum for the constitution. He said it 1 month and a half ago when he was in New York. And you have people who is working for him here. We have a meeting maybe every week since a year. And the prime minister say clearly that the government agree that they are going to a new constitution. In Guinean constitution, if you change the constitution, like give the possibility to president to have a third term. So this is very clear for us, you know. We only say, if you don't want no problem about it, you just have to say that, okay, there will be no modification of a constitution, there will be no over-election about this question, and everybody will be free.
In terms of protests, what is next? Are you planning more protests?
We continue to protest tomorrow because now we have the bankers with us, we have the teachers, and I think tomorrow will be another day of protest. And maybe we'll take 1 or 2 days to let people go to market. You know, Guinea is a very poor country. During the 9 years of Alpha Condé, he didn't give any possibility to find work and just nothing, you know. In 9 years, we have no hospital, no university, 100 kilometers of road, no electricity, no water supply. So people have to go to market every time because there is no electricity. So we have to let them go to market maybe 1, 2 days before they start again.
Sidya Touré is the leader of the Opposition Union of Republican Forces Party of Guinea. He was speaking with us from the capital, Conakry. VOA reached a government spokesman, Amara Sampare, but he said the government has designated the interior minister to handle all questions about the protests. Today is Wednesday, October 16th, and you are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. Zimbabwe's finance minister, Mthuli Mbe, says the country's economy is facing temporary problems, and he is hopeful that the economy will bounce back from what he calls a transition state. Mbe is currently in Washington to attend this year's International Monetary Fund and World Bank meetings. Mbe tells reporter Marvelous Nyawui of VOA Zimbabwe service that his delegation will hold a Zimbabwe roundtable today, Wednesday, with foreign investors to discuss the progress on Zimbabwe's economic reforms.
Yes, I've come here to attend the annual meetings of the IMF and the World Bank. These are the annual meetings, and we've come to discuss various things that affect the global economy, that affect our economies, and that also affect Zimbabwe. And we're going to have a Zimbabwe roundtable on Wednesday to discuss the progress on reforms on Zimbabwe.
Where is this roundtable going to be, and what are you hoping to achieve from the roundtable? Because we see the Zimbabwean economy is currently in free flow.
Well, the economy is reforming quite fast, actually. These reforms are largely positive. They are setting the economy up for a very bright future and prosperity towards Vision 2030. What we're facing is a temporary challenge, a transition period, while the currency is trying to find its feet. Remember, this currency is new. This Zimbabwe dollar is trying to find its feet. It will stabilize. We'll do everything we can as government to stabilize it.
Talking about the currency, a lot of people are really against the bond note and are actually pushing for you as Zimbabwe to go back to the US dollar. What's the situation regarding that?
Well, the bond note is our currency. It is part of the Zimbabwe dollar definition. So really, it's a currency that we ought to be proud of, we should make use of. There's no way that Zimbabwe can use a US dollar in terms of a one-to-one exchange rate. That kind of exchange rate is detrimental to the economy. It cannot compete. It will, you know, lead to industrialization, which was already happening to our industry. So a weaker, more competitive currency is key. What should happen is that perhaps we should spend more time thinking about how to do wage adjustments, and we've done a lot already to make sure that purchasing power can be restored. Again, you can't do it in one shot. It is gradual. It takes time, but it will come right.
And you're here at a MEFMI meeting. How important is MEFMI for Zimbabwe?
MEFMI is very important to where the host in Zimbabwe, the head office is Zimbabwe. It combines various governments, central banks. They come together. And its role is to become a platform for knowledge sharing on how to manage the fiscal side of things, how to manage monetary policy, how to manage the financial systems for the betterment of the African economies. Mm-hmm. So it's very important to be here and to support what MEFMI does, because they help us do our jobs better.
Is Zimbabwe ever going back to the US dollar? What's your view on that?
Oh, well, we've got our own currency. We are moving on to the Zimbabwe dollar, which we have adopted. Remember, on the US dollar, you're still free to hold it in your bank accounts. You're still free to hold it under your mattress if you so wish. So really, it's about what currency you use for transacting within the economy. And it is Zimbabwe dollar. That's what you use for accounting as well.
Mthule Mumbe, Zimbabwe's finance minister, he spoke in Washington with reporter Marvelous Nyahuyi of VOA Zimbabwe service. A new report by the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, shows that a high number of children are suffering the consequences of poor diets. Issued ahead of World Food Day today, Wednesday, the report says that at least one in three children under 5 or 200 million are either undernourished or overweight. Mavis Ocheri has details from Washington.
The report indicates that almost 2 in 3 children between 6 months and 2 years of age do not eat food that supports their rapidly growing bodies and brains. Juan Maggi is the UNICEF Regional Nutrition Advisor for Eastern and Southern Africa. She says 340 million children in the world suffer from deficiencies in essential vitamins and nutrients such as vitamin A and iron. She says this puts them at risk of poor brain development, learning difficulties, low immunity, infection, and in many cases, death. She says in Eastern and Southern Africa, Rwanda is the first country that has scaled up efforts on providing micronutrients powder to improve the diet of all children aged between 6 to 23 months.
In the same region, we have countries such as Rwanda, Tanzania, Kenya, and Ethiopia, where we are starting to see a gradual decline in stunting, and that can be influenced by just economic growth within the country, scaled up interventions at community level that are addressing malnutrition and attempts to improve the diets of children.
She says that millions of children in Africa are eating too little of what they need, and millions are eating too much of what they do not need. That means nearly 2 in every 5 children who are not growing as they should. Maggi says in all the regions, UNICEF works in, Africa is the only one where stunting is not going down. She says this is partly due to the continent's rapidly growing population of children under age 5. She says out of 149 million children who are stunted or too short for their age in the world, 29 are in Eastern and Southern Africa. Correcting that situation is costly.
We also have data that shows that the cost of managing and helping a child to recover from severe acute malnutrition ranges from $110 to $150 for full recovery of that child.
A key element to addressing nutrition issues, Maggie says, is working with local governments to train frontline health workers to manage care for children suffering from acute malnutrition or undernutrition. The care needs to be done through special nutrition centers. Maggie says, just as UNICEF is committed to meeting the challenges of undernutrition and hidden hunger, the organization must also work with government to respond to the new challenge of childhood obesity. She says that also threatens the well-being of children everywhere. For instance, she said governments should create policies that protect children from irresponsible marketing of unhealthy foods. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Washington.
Tens of thousands face evictions as Kenya's government intensifies efforts to reclaim the Mau, East Africa's largest indigenous mountain forest, an important source of water for the region. Rael Ombo reports.
42-year-old Josephat Langat rummages through the remains of what was once his business in Sierra Leone, a town in Kenya's Mau Forest. He says a truckload of police arrived one early morning and forced residents to tear down their homes and businesses. He says the land they occupied was legally bought.
We bought. Most of us, we came from Kericho, Nakuru, all over the country. Reaching here, we have been cultivating up to 205. They came here, they told us, this land, you are living here illegally. Then we wondered, how can you say we are living illegally, yet we have documents?
Kenya began evicting people from the forest last year to protect its fragile ecosystem. In August, the government announced plans to evict another 60,000 people from the forest. Rights group like Human Rights Watch says authorities should provide residents with adequate notice and compensation and ensure that police officials do not use unlawful force in removing settlements. Otieno Namwai is a senior Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch.
Human Rights Watch is not saying that conservation should not happen. We actually hold the view that conservation is very important and the environment needs to be conserved. However, we are saying that government can still do conservation legally and in a manner that respects human rights.
In a recent report, rights group documented 9 deaths that took place during the July 2018 eviction process. The block where the current evictions are taking place is Masai Mau, managed by the county government of Narok and government-run Kenya Forest Service. Appearing before a parliamentary committee probing the evictions, Kenya's cabinet secretary for the environment, Keriako Tobiko, defended the government's move to protect the forest.
Even if, for argument's sake, Masai Mau are not still trust land under the county government of Narok, if there are processes and activities that destroy the environment, the ecological value of that asset, the national government has the responsibility to come in to eliminate processes and activities that are likely to endanger the environment.
Encroachments into the forest are affecting livelihoods further away. Rainfall patterns have become unpredictable, and the Mara River, whose source is in the Mau, has become polluted and receded significantly, says environmental lawyer Kitipa Naikumi.
In the process of keeping the people in the Mau, we are probably wiping a whole generation downstream in the Mara, within the Mara ecosystem. And so, well, the balancing of right, the right to a humane process of leaving the Mau, and the right for the people who live downstream.
As for Josephat Langat and other evictees, they say they hope they will get justice from a government they say betrayed them. Rael Umbur for VOA News, Narok, Kenya.
This week, anthropologist Katie Kilroy Marak is in the car to speak about her book, An Impossible Inheritance, post-colonial psychiatry and the work of a memory in West African clinic. The book tells the story of a distinctive project in transcultural psychiatry that was initiated at the Fan Psychiatry Clinic in Dakar during the 1960s and 1970s. Kilroy Marak spoke to Ricky Stryak about the issues addressed in the book and how they persist today.
A lot of what he did kind of revolved around the concept of culture related to local, so Wolof and Lebu, but even Serer, ceremonies, ways of thinking about mental illness and healing. And so he was really, really interested in culture. Culture was really at the center of his project. This group was a mostly, you know, they tried to be as eclectic as possible, but within the clinic, the doctors were mostly French, right? He did also train the first generation of Senegalese psychiatrists. When he finally left in 1978 to go back to France, the Senegalese psychiatrists who took over really distanced themselves from the project that he had set up and had run all those years that focused on culture.
Why?
Puzzles that I kind of look at is, I mean, something that on first glance seems kind of counterintuitive, right? That the Senegalese psychiatrists take over and they distance themselves from the culture project. In some ways, this culture project was a project that was associated with a kind of colonial or neo-colonial regime.
Is there a refocus now toward these methods?
I think there still is a tension toward what's happening in a family and how family relations can be at the source of conflict that can make problems much worse for people. And yet there also still, amongst the doctors working in the clinic, is this idea that psychiatric problems exist in the brain, right? They don't originate in social relationships. They originate in the brain, and social relationships can make them worse.
And it's kind of antithesis to the way a lot of traditional systems approach mental health.
Exactly. Exactly. And so if a patient comes to FAN now, a patient is put on medication, you know, there are pinch ceremonies. There is art therapy. Of course, really, it's only men who go to art therapy, not women. There are some crafts that social workers try to get the women engaged in, you know, kind of occupational therapy stuff. People are staying there. They're kind of being monitored. And the idea is taking a little bit of time out of their lives and then taking this medication, they'll be able to reintegrate themselves into their daily normal, which is kind of the goal, right? To be able to go back to where you came from and be functioning well. So I had one nurse, for example, tell me not too long ago, you know, when we come in, we often see that the patient is in conflict with his or her family. And we see that as a sign that the patient is sick, a sign that the patient isn't well. And so as the patient takes medication and stays at the clinic, we see those relationships improve, and that tells us that the patient is getting better. That's a very different thing than looking at family relationships as a possible source of malaise or of suffering.
That was Katie Kilroy Marak, an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Toronto. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar, Senegal. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Liberian police used tear gas on Tuesday to disperse public school students who were demonstrating to demand their teachers' pay. Some students said their teachers have not been paid for 4 months. The Ministry of Finance says it has disbursed the September salaries of the teachers at the Monrovia Consolidated School System. Minister of Information Eugene Nambwe says the government is currently restructuring its pay system, which accounts for the delay. Guinean opposition political parties and civil society groups say they plan more protests today, Wednesday, against a possible third-term bid by President Alpha Condé. That's it for this Wednesday, October 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I'm James Butt in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music, and Africa is my passion. join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.